culture.
I don't know the whole truth. I don't know what happened to her.
Wish I didn't believe you. You know, it's very hard to trust someone you don't understand. You're a very strange man.
You have no idea.
That was actor Jeremy Irons in his Academy Award-winning performance as the duplicitous Klaus Van Bülow in the 1990 film Reversal of Fortune. The other voice you heard was actor Ron Silver playing his defense attorney, Alan Dershowitz, who, sadly, wasn't nominated for an Oscar. And neither was the relatively unknown actor playing that small yet crucial cameo as a judge. What a shame. Back to real life, our guest today is the real Alan Dershowitz, a man who's enjoyed a prolific legal career defending everyone and everything from celebrities like heiress Patty Hearst, boxer Mike Tyson, the First Amendment, due process, and increasingly, the right for Israel's existence. And it's that passionate defense of Israel that's occupied much of the public's perception of Alan these days, leading to some calling him Israel's most visible defender and the Jewish state's lead attorney in the court of public opinion. This is evidenced by his many, many books on the subject, his latest being Terror Tunnels, The Case for Israel's Just War Against Hamas, out now in ebook form and available on November 18th in hardcover if, like myself, you prefer your books on paper. Mr. Dershowitz, thank you and welcome to the program.
Thanks. You know, I used to prefer my books on paper, even to write them on paper, but now, you know, I wrote this book while the Gaza War was going on, and I finished it on a Thursday night. By Friday, it was online. By Monday, it was a bestseller. So you can get real-time contact with your audience through ebooks. So I love ebooks, and it's $5 on a Kindle and Amazon, and I'm going to write more ebooks now. So you folks that want to read, you know, paper books, I don't know, I guess I'll publish them in paper as well, but the ebook has become really my favorite.
No, I actually have a copy on my iPod. I'm almost finished with it, actually. So, you know, you and Stephen King are advocates of paper and digital. I think it's great because people are reading again. I love it.
Yeah, no, and young people are reading, and that's the great thing. I have, you know, a daughter who's in her 20s, and all of her friends, they don't even know what a book is or a newspaper. Everything's online.
You know, what's funny, I actually wanted to talk to you last year because I actually read your autobiography, or should I say, your daughter read it to me because I actually had the Audible version.
That's right, and she was the reader. That was great. I love that. It's the only way I get my daughter to read any books that I write.
No, that was fantastic. She did a great job. And although I won't lie to you, sometimes I prefer to have the author read because there's just something there. But
I do too, and I've read most of my own books, but, you know, I'm getting a little older now, and so the idea of spending 4 or 5 days in the studio reading a book, I'd rather have my daughter do it.
Well, I'll give you my agent's number, and we'll work something out.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway, Terror Tunnels. I know this has been a subject that I think a lot of Americans have become a little fatigued about, and I think I know why, and I think you know why, too. Every day we turn on the news, we turn to our newspapers, and we find yet another crisis in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
And it's going to continue. It's never going to stop because it's the media's fault. It's the fault of the United Nations. It's the fault of many in Europe. What they do is every time Israel tries to defend itself, they condemn Israel. Whenever Hamas uses human shields and puts children and babies in harm's way in order to get Israel to kill Palestinian children so that they can use what I call in Terror Tunnels the dead baby strategy, Hamas wins. It wins in the court of public opinion. So why not? If you're Hamas's advisor and you see that every time you're in a war with Israel, you lose on the ground, but you win in the international court of public opinion, you win in the international regular courts, you win in European parliaments, why not do it again? So my prediction here, 2 years from now, Hamas builds new tunnels, new rockets. We're at it again. The summer of 2016, we will see another war by Hamas. Another 2,000 people will die, and Hamas will win in the court of public opinion. 2018, same thing again. It's just going to repeat itself over and over again, and that's why we get all kind of fatigue.
You know, it's funny, and I don't mean funny as in funny, but my Twitter feed. I'm not the biggest fan of Twitter, but I got to tell you, it exploded with pictures of dead children from the conflict.
Of course, and it's their plan. It's their idea that not only do they put children in front of their rockets and in front of their tunnels, But they even used pictures of children who were born, who were killed in Syria by rebels or by the Syrian authorities, and they say, oh, these are pictures of Palestinian children who were killed. The media eats it up. They love it. And they don't show context. They don't show why these children were killed. You know, I'll give you an example. I mentioned this example in my book, Terror Tunnels. A guy goes in and robs a bank. He has a gun. He holds a child hostage. He starts shooting from behind the child at customers in the bank. Policemen come in, and they have to stop him from shooting. They try to take careful aim at his head, but he lifts the child up at the last minute, and the child is killed. Who's guilty? Not the policeman who shot the fatal shot, but clearly the man who took the hostage. So, you know, if the media would just realize that when you hold people hostage in front of your guns and rockets and tunnels, you purposely want them to die, and Israel has no choice. It has to protect its own civilians. The tunnel that I was in before I wrote the book was right near 57 children in a kindergarten. So you're the Israeli prime minister. You say, look, there are 57 children who could be killed, or there may be some Palestinians who are using as human shields. Who do you pick? I mean, what do you do? These are hard moral choices, but you always have to prefer the lives of your own civilians over the lives of human shields. And it's going to get worse because ISIS is using it now. Iran is going to use it. They're going to hide their nuclear facilities underneath hospitals and mosques and schools. And they're going to say to America or to Israel, if you want to come after us, you're going to have to kill civilians. And, you know, we're decent people. We don't want to kill civilians. Israel goes to tremendous lengths to avoid it. It sends leaflets out. It drops little noise-making bombs. It sends telephone messages, texts. But some of these people insist on being martyrs, and others are forced at gunpoint. So what do you do?
Well, you know, it's funny, in World War II, when the Americans were going to drop bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they did similar efforts to try to clear out the populace. But mm-hmm. you listen to how it's presented now, and it almost acts like a unmitigated attack just to kill as many civilians as possible.
No, that was certainly not the goal. The goal was to try to save the lives of American soldiers, probably hundreds of thousands of whom would have been killed had there been an invasion of the main island. The same thing was true with Churchill's decision to bomb Dresden. I mean, he didn't want to kill civilians. He's not at war with children and babies, but he said there had to be some demoralization of the German population, much the way the Germans tried to demoralize the British population by bombing London, by bombing Coventry, by killing so many civilians. You know, tragically, civilian deaths are a consequence of war, and when you start a war, as Hamas did against Israel, you know there are going to be some consequences to civilians, and that's why the fault has to be with the people who send the rockets and build the tunnels and send the terrorists.
You know, following the July initiation of this recent conflict, you know, going back to Twitter for a minute, people, especially in the wake of the Arab Spring, it's pretty incredible how savvy some of these people have become in using the social media to spread this message without context. And
that's
I think,
right. Yeah.
You know, we talked about that. And it's pretty savage because, you know, you look at a younger generation, you know, I'm not part of the millennials, but people just lower than myself, they seem to not want context in a lot of these things. You can't spread context in a 160-character message.
I know, I agree with that, and that's why I wrote my book. It's a short book, but it's a punchy and powerful book to show the case for Israel's just war against Hamas. That's why I come on shows like this, to try to explain context, to try to say, ask, what would you do? President Obama went to Sderot where the rockets were hitting just before he became president, and he said, if rockets were coming at my children's homes, I would do everything in my power to stop them, and I expect Israel will do the same. And President Obama has been quite supportive, generally, of Israel's self-defense actions. I think he overstated it when he said Israel could do more to reduce civilian casualties. It actually couldn't do more to reduce civilian casualties. The United States is learning that now when they fight ISIS, and ISIS is hiding among populated areas, and they're going to use some of their hostages as human shields as well, and we're going to see how difficult it is. And, you know, the United States has some lessons they can actually learn from Israel instead of berating a fellow democracy for trying to protect its own civilians.
You know, it's funny, when we talk about human civilians, you also talk about corporate civilians. You know, I know in your book you talk about the BDS movement, the boycott, divestment, mm-hmm. and sanctions. You know, you see this a lot where these certain groups, they with their well-stated goals, they want to sort of bully these companies into divesting from Israel.
And only Israel. There's no boycott movement against China for its repression of the Tibetans. There's no boycott movement against Russia for its invasion of the Ukraine and its repression of the Chechens. There's no boycott movement against anybody. Only Israel is the only subject of any kind of a boycott movement. And yet, you know, Israel is a democracy, helps the United States greatly in its fight against ISIS with intelligence on the ground and in the air. And why Israel? And I believe that if Israel were not the nation state of the Jewish people, there would not be such incredible double standard application of this to the nation state of the Jewish people. I'm not saying that everybody who wants to be in the BDS movement is anti-Semitic. I am saying that the fact that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people is a relevant factor in why there's so much focus on Israel's imperfections when so many countries in the world have greater imperfections. When we fought against Afghanistan and Iraq and invaded some areas of Pakistan, we killed far, far more civilians. The ratio was about 4-1, four civilians for every terrorist, when our allies, NATO and the United States and the coalition went in. And Israel's ratio is approximately 1-1, much, much better.
You know, what's interesting is that it doesn't take a genius to figure out a lot of where this originates from. You know, you look at the parallel groups that are part of the BDS movement, and you look at some of the anti-American groups, especially the ones in Europe. And I, you know,
Sure, Code Pink, for example, Code Pink, this radical feminist anti-American, anti-Israel, anti-democratic, hard left group. It's against everything decent.
You know, what's funny though is that what's interesting is that it's this whole recent campaign has brought you over to the side of almost the conservative movement. You know, when I grew up listening to you and watching you on television, reading your books, you were a darling of the progressives, and now it seems like the progressives, because they've so many of the progressive movement is so aligned with anti-Israeli movements, that it's almost brought you into the favor of conservatives. That must be very strange.
Well, I hope I'm favored by conservatives, but I hope I'm also favored by thinking liberals. When you think of a woman like Judith Butler, who's the head of the BDS campaign, she says Hamas is a progressive organization. A progressive organization. It represses women, it kills gays, it hangs people without any due process, it imposes capital punishment all over the place. That's not progressive, that's regressive. And so I'm the true progressive. The people who support Hamas and some who support ISIS and Hezbollah, they're not progressives, they're phonies. I still maintain my liberal credentials on issues of equality, of gay rights, of a woman's right to choose, separation of church and state, health care. I'm a conventional liberal Democrat, centrist liberal Democrat. I'm not a conservative, and I hope that Israel doesn't ever become, in this country, an issue that divides liberals and conservatives. Fortunately, thinking people from both sides generally support Israel. Democrats support Israel, Republicans do, but there is more support from Israel among conservatives than among hard left radicals. And, you know, I've never thought of radicals as liberals or civil libertarians. Many of them are old-fashioned Stalinists who supported Stalin when he wanted to repress human rights, but he could do no wrong because he was a communist. Today, some of the same people are making the same statements about Hamas. They can do no wrong because they're what? They're anti-colonialist, or they're anti-Israel, or they're anti-American. It's total nonsense. I haven't changed my view. The world around me has changed.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily just anti-Israel. I think when you look at all of these movements, Alan, you see, like you said, the pro-feminist movement, the pro-gay movement. It's not necessarily that if you're anti-gay marriage, you're anti-homosexual or you're anti...
Of course.
Yeah, but they've turned it into this. And one thing I really wanted to get your thought on is the anti-Semitism. That's real. When I see what's happening in France, that's not a demonstration against Israel.
Look, there are three kinds of anti-Semitism that are operating in Europe today. They're very distinct, but they're beginning to overlap. One of them is the old-fashioned right-wing fascist anti-Semitism in countries like Hungary and Greece, which vote for fascist parties which are anti-Muslim, anti-Jewish, anti-Roma, anti-everything. You know, they're super-nationalists. That's the extreme right. Those are the people who would have supported Hitler, and many of them did. Many of their parents and grandparents did. Okay, that's one part. The other part is Islamic anti-Semitism, which is rampant in parts of Europe. Not all Muslims are anti-Semites, but a large percentage of them are, and that becomes part of the movement. And then third is the academic and union hard left, the Stalinists, basically, who, when they get orders from the former Soviet Union, turn against Israel. They do, without thinking, because the one thing, if you're a hard-left Stalinist, you're not allowed to think. You have to just follow orders. It has to be politically correct. And for them, it's not politically correct to support Israel, to support the United States, to support free market economy, to support liberalism. Liberals are the great enemy of the hard left. So those are the three forms of anti-Semitism we're seeing. The most interesting are among some Jews, who are hard left and anti-American and anti-Israel, and some of them have morphed over to using some anti-Semitic tropes. But, you know, Jews are like anybody else. They include some people who are self-hating and who can't deal with their own background or ethnicity.
You know, it's interesting is that, but if you make that argument, I think you face this, you get accused of pro-Zionism, that the idea is that any discussion about Jewish equality in this context is considered pandering. And I'm very disappointed that many of my friends who call themselves progressive have fallen into this, and it's difficult to talk with someone when you're not having a discussion but an argument.
Of course. First of all, Zionism is a progressive movement. It's the national liberation movement of the Jewish people. It has always been a liberal movement. It has always been supported by liberals around the world. Some of the greatest supporters of Zionism have been liberals. And when Israel was first established, it was recognized immediately by the Soviet Union, by Czechoslovakia, by all the left European nations. All the left in America supported it. Pete Seeger used to sing songs in Hebrew to support Israel. Then when the Soviet Union changed, all these guys changed on a dime. They stopped thinking and they just immediately went against Israel. So I'm a proud Zionist. Zionism just means the right of the Jewish people to have one country among the several hundred in the world, the 40 or 50 Muslim nations, the many, many Christian nations, the nations of other faiths and other traditions and backgrounds. There's room in the world for one, just one, nation state of the Jewish people, which will always be open to Jews who are oppressed in other parts of the world. It's never been more needed than now. Many French Jews are emigrating to Israel. Hungarian Jews are emigrating to Israel. Greek Jews are emigrating to Israel because of the anti-Semitism in their country. And history has proved that, you know, if there had been an Israel in the 1930s, probably 2 or 3 million of the 6 million who were killed could have been saved.
You know, it's very sad that when we have these discussions, you ask for, not you personally, but the general public asks for consensus. And on one hand, you look in the area and you look at which area is civilized in a way that has roads, medicine, hospitals, libraries, education, and you look at which doesn't, and you look what is socially repressive against gays, against females. Mm-hmm. That's not a good starting off point if you're talking about equality between the two cultures.
And I think Of course not. You also look at the country that has contributed more to medical technology, life-saving technology, than any country in the world per capita, and that's Israel. You look at the country that has been the only reliable ally of America in the Middle East. Look at Turkey. Turkey is turning against America. It's turning against the Kurds. It's turning in favor of ISIS. It's undercutting the efforts of NATO. They're not a reliable ally. Will Jordan be a reliable ally in a year from now? Who knows? Will Saudi Arabia, which isn't even a country, it's a family-owned gas station, be a supporter and ally of the United States with their Wahhabism? But everybody knows that no matter who's elected in Israel, Israel will always be America's most reliable ally in the Middle East, providing them intelligence, providing them technology, providing them anything that the United States wants, essentially.
It's tragic that I have to bring it up, but you know, you look at the recent ISIS beheading videos in regards to what's happening over in Iraq, you know, and you have these poor families. They're making these pleas, these carefully scripted pleas about appealing to their good nature and their power, and the impression gives is that you can talk these people down, but I don't think that's true.
I don't think so. You can pay them down if you're willing to pay enormous amounts of money, which they will then use to capture, kidnap, and behead other people. So it's a no-win proposition. And then you get to just turn to something else that's a little bit controversial. You get in New York, the Metropolitan Opera, which I love and have been going to since I'm 15 years old, decides to put on an opera called The Death of Klinghoffer, which glorifies terrorists that murdered an old Jewish man in a wheelchair on a boat and threw him overboard. Can you imagine the opera putting on The Death of Martin Luther King, glorifying the racists who killed him? Or, you know, The Death of the person who was beheaded recently by ISIS, glorifying ISIS for killing him? But it's fair game, apparently, with the Metropolitan Opera, to put on an opera which creates a moral equivalence between people who would kill a wheelchair-bound man and the wheelchair-bound man himself. I'm not in favor of violence or anything like that to shut down an opera, but I think those of us who think it showed bad judgment and bad taste to show this opera certainly have a right to express our views equally with their right to show their opera.
I would never call for censorship, but I think that if you were to check off the boxes that would include the people that would put on that show, I think a lot of them would be shared with the same people who would desecrate Christian symbolatry and crosses and urine.
You have artistic freedom to do all that, but should you do it? I mean, that just seems you are responsible for the artistic choices you make. And an artist who uses elephant dung to portray Jesus has shown horrible, horrible bad taste. I would defend his right to do it, but I would criticize his exercise of that right. I defended the rights of Nazis to march through Skokie, Illinois, while criticizing, obviously, the Nazis. So we should never confuse artistic freedom with artistic judgment.
No, and you know, it's funny. I don't think that things are going to change very much. But I think that the more we have this dialogue, I think maybe something will get through.
I hope so, and that's why I write my books like Terror Tunnels. That's why you have your show, and that's why we have to keep talking, and we have to create more audiences and more ways of getting to people to try to influence their opinion in a positive way, to expand the marketplace of ideas for young people, for people of every age.
Well, Alan, thank you very much for joining us today. I know you're pretty busy, and if anybody's listening, Terror Tunnels, The Case for Israel's Just War Against Hamas, out now in ebook. If disappointingly you're like Alan, you prefer digital, but if you're like me and you prefer paper, it'll be out November 18th. Alan, thank you very much
for
showing.
My pleasure. Bye.
The Pop Zara podcast is executive produced by Chris Mitchell. All original content and features broadcast throughout the Pop Zara podcast are copyright 2014 Pippo Publishing, LLC. All music and assorted sounds used throughout the podcast are copyright to their respective owners and legal entities. For more fabulous features and digital delights, be sure to check out The Whole Enchilada at popzara.com.